I would now like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Paul M. from San Diego.
Hi, my name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
And thank you for asking me to come share here tonight. During this little break here, I got a little taste of what the program really is. Is that I was fortunate enough to stop and talk with a newcomer. And during this process, and this is what I've discovered in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that left up to my own devices and my own ego, I'll start to forget what it's really like out there. And the whole purpose for me coming to a meeting, any meeting, is that this is where newcomers come. They don't come to my house. They come here. They come to meetings. And so when I'm blessed enough to stop and talk with a new man, and I'm able to look him in the eyes, I get to go right back to that moment. Right back to that moment, and I get to remember the actual truth of what this thing is. You know, not what I distort it to be, but the real truth of what this thing is. My sobriety date is January 17th, 1994. And for those of you who don't remember that, that's the day the earth shook. That was the Northridge earthquake. And I'm sitting in Balboa Park hitting this little glass pipe, because that's part of my story. And all of a sudden, my truck started shaking. And I went, holy shit, what a hit. And every time I did that, I kept saying, I'm going to treatment tomorrow. And I went to treatment the next day. But that was at the end of an amazing run. How it started was my first drink was I was a little kid. I don't even remember how old. And my real father handed me a jalapeno pepper. And I was just a little tyke, maybe 3 or 4 years old. And about my third trip around the house, he handed me a beer. You know, it was so hot that I just kept running around the house. And he handed me a beer. And I remember that. My first drunk was, I think, about 13 years old. And I had heard that if you stuck a straw in a can of beer, you would get drunk, right? And so this can of beer was a Colt 45 malt liquor. And so, I mean, I had no idea at the time, you know. I just heard these things, you know. So I stuck a straw in the can of beer and got drunk. And I loved it. I loved it. See, I believe that I am genetically disposed to have this illness, as it were. I believe that this gene that I caught causes or creates my body not to metabolize alcohol correctly. That's the gene that was passed down through generations in my family. It didn't cause me to have the ism part of this. It didn't cause me to have alcoholism. It created me to be alcoholic, but not to have the disease alcoholism. That's my own self-centeredness. What happened is after that first drunk, it kind of changed my perception a lot. I used to stutter, and when I first got sober, I couldn't speak, and there's a lot of people who wish I still can't, but that's too bad. But when I first got sober, I couldn't speak. I had such a bad speech impediment that I just couldn't talk. And all growing up through my entire life, it was that way. If I thought in elementary school, if I thought a new kid in class was going to laugh at me about my stuttering, just my perception, right? When the teacher left, I went up and smacked him, right? Without him even opening up his mouth, I knew he was going to make fun of me. And that's how my life was growing up. There was an alcoholic father in my life up until the age of like 8, I believe, 6 or 8. And what happened is my mother had enough. She just had enough of this man, of him beating the kids, of beating her, of just the things that alcoholics do in their cusp. And what happened is my mom came home from work one day and said, this man is not coming home. And all 6 of us kids grabbed weapons. We grabbed hammers. We grabbed baseball bats. We grabbed whatever we could find and circled the house. This man was not coming back. And that started a life of poverty. You know, the father was gone. He was a crippled from a drug driving accident. He was crippled, and he never did get sober. He died, I believe, in 1984. He died in his own vial, and that's where I was heading, and I know this. And so what that started was a life of poverty and a life of knowing that I didn't fit in, of seeing kids. I grew up or was raised in South Carolina, the Southern Baptist Belt, and seeing kids who had things and knowing that I didn't measure up. And I went to this Southern Baptist church and was told that I couldn't join the Boy Scouts because I didn't have enough money. You know, just over and over again in my life, there were always these little seeds planted that I just didn't quite measure up. And so what happened is that I tried to excel in sports, and I still couldn't talk. You know, so I fought my way through life. And sometime around the age of 13 or 14, I believe, was when I stuck that straw in that can of a beer, and it changed my perception of everything. Finally, I could talk, and then there was I remember the first time I smoked a joint. It changed everything. And from that time, from 14 to about 15, everything progressed so much that I OD'd on this stuff called crystal. This friend and I from down the block, we went to this deep, dark alley somewhere in South Carolina and got this little bag of white powder, right? Went back to his room, and he opened it up and stuck a little knife in it and snorted it. And, you know, and what happened is I did the same thing, but I didn't get that instant gratification. I didn't get that fix. And so what I did is I took a pin apart, stuck the pin down it, and all of it went up my nose. And the next thing I know, I'm waking up in the hospital 3 days later. I was gone. The ambulance, everybody said I was dead. It was Thanksgiving Day. I don't remember the year, 74 or 75. And that stopped me from using drugs for a long time. I mean, for a long time, I wouldn't even do aspirin. You know, that affected me so much. It affected my family so much that at that moment, I was able to stop the drugs. You know, and our literature talks about the real alcoholic versus the hard drinker. If given sufficient reason, the hard drinker can stop or moderate. Well, I was always able to stop or moderate the drugs. I was never able to stop and moderate the alcohol. I could see where crystal and the drugs that I was doing was affecting my life. And so I was able to set those aside. So what I refer myself to is that crystal's my drug of choice and alcohol's my drug of no choice. And so, you know, I am powerless physically over alcohol because of this allergy that I have. And I'm mentally powerless over alcohol when I don't have a correct spirit in me. And so what happened is my family was uprooted from the South after I OD'd. And we were moved up to this little farming community in northeastern Indiana. Nothing but the five S. Right, there's fishing, farming, fighting, factories, and whatever. Yeah. And so that's what, you know, it was nothing else there. And in between these little corn rows, the farmers grew this stuff. You know, and so it was off and running again. And what happened there was I started drinking more. I was in high school, and in high school I also worked in this factory, and I had smoked. I smoked a tobacco pipe, and I can remember putting pot into this tobacco pipe and standing on top of this humongous steel grinder that I was running. The air would go in, and then it would come out the top of the roof as exhaust. And I'm sitting there getting stoned, running this piece of equipment that would just kill me. And the boss is driving around, and I thought I was so cool. I thought I had it going on. And I got fired from that job because the boss's son, the owner's son, he was messing around with this girl that I was seeing. And I didn't like that. So I just walked up and punched him. And unfortunately, he was in an automobile at the time. And he didn't put it in gear or didn't put it in park. And what happened when I hit him, he went down. His foot hit the gas. He did a 360 and smacked right in the back of a wall. Destroyed his car. Messed him up. He was in the hospital for a month. And I'm just sitting there watching this. Now, over and over again, my life, there is stories like that to where I don't get my way, I get angry and get resentful. What happened after this is that I joined the Navy. I couldn't buy a job in northeastern Indiana. And so I thought that if I would join the Navy, I could play chess because I love to play chess, and I could drink. That was my whole purpose for joining the Navy. right? Drinking and playing chess. I never played one single game in the Navy, one single game of chess in the Navy. Not one, but drank a lot. And so things just kept progressing. I think the story is a part in Bill's story where he talks about that he gets so drunk it almost failed his law degree. You know, well, it was the night that I was supposed to take the final test at this A school that I was going to in Great Lakes, and I got trashed because there was a bar right outside the base that was selling these little draft beers for a quarter apiece. Right? And I almost didn't make that. You know, and so when I read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I related to a lot of things that I read in there. I tried every imaginable remedy to stay sober, and it didn't work. I used to think that if I just drank three beers, that would prove that I'm not alcoholic. You know, if I could just, but after a while, who cares? Just keep drinking. And so what happened in the Navy was we were just getting ready to pull out on my one and only Westpac. And I got this message from the American Red Cross that said my biological father had just died. I didn't know the man. I only had met him a few times, so I knew nothing about him. And at first, I wadded the piece of paper up and threw it away. And then all of a sudden, the thought hit me. I get emergency leave. So I took this piece of paper out of the trash can, unfolded it, you know, and put this sad face on, went up to the chief engineer, showed it to him. And next thing I know, I'm being catapulted off this aircraft carrier, right, heading for Guam and Diego Garcia and just all these fun places. And and that started a month of just straight drinking. You know, and I had this piece of paper. It was called the emergency chit, I think they called it at the time. And so I bounced around the world and wound up in San Diego. I never did make it to my dad's funeral. And I wound up back here in San Diego. And then they shipped me out to this place called Diego Garcia. And it's a crazy place. A lot of beer drinking. It was good. And then I screwed up there and wasn't able to make it to this watch. All I had to do was show up for 4 hours a night, right? And I couldn't do it. And so the next day I'm on this aircraft or this airplane heading back to meet the ship in the Philippines. And as I land in the Philippines, and as I'm driving from this Air Force base down to Longapo where the ship is, I'm sitting here looking at my orders, and it said fly to Manila. And it dawned on me that I had flown to Manila. It didn't tell me what to do after that. And so I spent the next 3 or 4 days between Manila and Longapo just raising hell and partying. And when I finally did get back to the ship, they arrested me and threw me in the brig for missing an appointed place of duty. And being the keen mind that I have, I showed him this little chit, you know, these orders, and it said fly to Manila. I said, it did not tell me what to do after that. And so they let me go. I mean, what else could you do? Yeah, I mean, yeah, this master at arms, he was the chief redhead guy, and he was livid. But here's me, this cocky young seaman, you know, this cocky young little guy, and I think a lot, you know. I'm an analytical kind of guy, you know. So that's kind of what I looked at. And so after the Navy, you know, it's kind of funny, but they never asked me to reenlist. I was probably the only person on the Kitty Hawk during that period of time that never got asked to reenlist, and I never quite figured that out. and so after the Navy, I kind of bounced around from jobs, and I wound up at the Hotel Del. I wound up at the Hotel Del as a maintenance guy, plant operator, running the power plant down in the basement. And I worked there for several years, and what I discovered there was the fine gift of scrap copper. This stuff is laying everywhere. And so so it was free money to me. So I started scrapping copper. Right? This was, I don't know what year it was, but it was a long time ago. And also I was working the night shift at the Hotel Del, which meant that I came in at like 11 o'clock when all the big bosses were gone, and I was down in this hole down in the bottom of underneath the parking lot. And what happened one particular night is that is that I came in drunk, which was pretty normal. And as I was sleeping this thing off, sitting at the control console, all of a sudden all these alarms started going off. All these alarms going off. And I look out at this generator, and there's a little fire going. So I think I better go put this fire out. And so I grabbed the extinguisher, I hit the panic button in the control gear, went out, put this fire out. But at this time, power was off to the hotel completely. There are two sources of power. One was the generator, which I had just burned up, and the other one was SDG&E power, right? So I got the generator back up and running, and there's this little sync scope that you need to do, to balance to get the generator and the SDG&E going the same. It's like trying to put two magnets together. It just doesn't work. And my eyes wouldn't quite focus. And when I hit this button, it tried to close like two magnets out of sequence, and there was a large bang. The generator was down, gone. Right, I had sheared a pin in the generator, so that power wasn't any good. And all my adrenaline, I reached down, and there was this, it's called a breaker. It's what you flip in your house to get the power going back, right? Well, except this one is larger than this podium. And it has this handle on it that you jack out, and that you load it with a spring, you push a button, it closes, everything's good. Well, my adrenaline was going. I'm pulling on this handle, and the handle comes off in my hand. The hotel is dead. No power whatsoever. And the next idea was that there should be plenty of scrap copper around to jump the bus. But I had taken all the scrap copper. So, needless to say, my job there was shortly over. And from there, it seemed like... job after job all wound up in the same thing. And finally what happened is I couldn't buy a job because I wouldn't go take a piss test, wouldn't go take a urinalysis to get the job, right? And so this very last job that I had when I got sober, I was a maintenance man, probably at your apartment building. And I had the keys to your house. Does this sound familiar? And so what I did was I would go in and I would help myself to some of your things. And primarily your checkbook. And I would go there, and at the very bottom of this box of checks, and the very last check, I would get the last one out and get a copy of your signature, and off I would go. And that lasted for a short time, not long, because what happened is during the business that I had, the realistic business that I had, I would go into this particular bank, and I knew that they checked where the check came from. I knew they verified signature, they verified everything. And I walked into that bank with this check I had forged. I knew it. I knew that they would do it, but I had, I don't know, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. And so what happened is obviously they didn't cash a check. And the next morning I went back to work, and the owner of the company was there, and all the bosses were there, and they said, "You got to go. The sheriffs are coming after you." And I went home to my wife at the house that was being foreclosed on, and told her I got to go. And that day, I commenced partying, which was my last hurrah. I went to the streets of San Diego, downtown, and commenced partying. And each time that I drank, each time that I would do my party favors, I would say, "I'm going to treatment tomorrow." And that's the night of the Northridge earthquake. And and that's just how I remember. What happened is that I can remember one very distinctive moment, like 2 days sober, right? See, I'm not really wanting to get sober, right? I have no intentions of getting sober, but the cops are out there, right? The cops are out there looking for me, right? They're out there, so I need to be here so I can figure out how to get out of this mess I'm in, because I'm in a mess, right? And so as I'm standing there on this bridge looking out over Interstate 8, it dawns on me that the whole world is going by and you don't care if I'm there or not. I am not that important. It doesn't matter if I'm dead or not. The world's going to continue. And that, for an ego-driven guy like me, that was, you know, that was an epiphany. You know, that's called these, you know, spiritual awakening right then. And what happened after that is because of the earthquake, the phone lines were down, and I was only supposed to be in this little spin drive for 3 days, wound up there for 10 days because they couldn't verify insurance or anything like that. And my time that I spent there, I started hearing about this thing about the allergy. Right? They took us to a meeting, and I'd never been to a meeting before. But in my shape, I looked at you and knew that you were just as bad as me because you wound up here too. And that was my mindset for a long time. I am not about to listen to you. I'm not about to take your advice because you wound up here too. How can you tell me how to live my life when you wound up here too? And that was pretty much my mindset with blinders on. And what happened in this treatment center was that I was introduced to this theory that I might have this allergy, that my body might not metabolize alcohol correctly. And so that is something that I couldn't deny. I could not deny that very cold, hard fact that when I drink, I wind up in places I don't count on. My body does not metabolize alcohol correctly. And at that moment, the cops were still out there looking for me. And so it was recommended that I go to this recovery home. And they bussed me around to a few of these recovery homes. And I walked into one. And as soon as I walked into this place, I had this overwhelming feeling that this is where I needed to be. And in that recovery home, I learned the grave nature of what I have. Not just the allergy part. I learned the grave nature of the obsession. Right? I learned what it meant to be powerless over alcohol. I was there for about 30 days in this recovery home, and the cops were still out there looking for me. And so I couldn't do it anymore. I could not live like I was living anymore. And so without telling anybody in this recovery home that I was at, because, again, I did not want your opinion. I didn't want you to sway what I was doing, because if I was to make a mistake, it was going to be because of me, not that I listened to you. And so I got a letter of residency from this place, and I went down to the Lemon Grove Sheriff Station and turned myself in. I went down there, went up to this lady at this booth, and said, told her what my name was. Said that this, you know, this is what I did, and you guys are looking for me. And she said, "There's nobody here. You got to come back later." It's a true story. It's a true story. It's a true story. And I went back out to my truck, and at that moment is the moment that I surrendered. Said, "I can't do this any longer." And I went back in, and I sat down, and I waited on him. I said, "No, I'll just wait." And I was there waiting on him for about an hour or so. And they finally came and arrested me. And I went to, in 3 days, I went to like three different courts. And the whole time, all I had was just this letter of residency from this recovery home. And it was the most damnedest thing I ever saw in my life. I had probation officers, I had the public defender and the district attorney all on my side saying, "Just give this guy, let him finish what he's doing, right? And then have him come back when he's done." So I did that. They let me go. I went back to this recovery house and finished up the process there. And I truly learned about this illness. I truly learned in this recovery home. It gave me the time, just the time, enough to stop this thing from spinning so much, to figure out what was going on and what the true nature of my condition really is. And the way I was taught, there's a little triangle up here, and on the very bottom of it is recovery, and that's what I need. Recovery is in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the way I was taught. I can stay sober on recovery, because I'll have a spiritual experience, I'll have a personality change. I may be miserable, but I will stay sober. But I can't stay sober on unity, and I will not stay sober on service. I might stay sober for just a few months, going to meetings and listening to your how your day is, right? I might stay sober for a few months going to answer phones somewhere. But eventually, this internal thing that I have, this internal discomfort about me being a jock who sings in a choir, who's always felt like I don't fit in, and, you know, I tell you, I sat around these rooms for about 6 months, I think, and was really afraid that I wasn't going to understand the secret handshake you guys were saying. You know, I wasn't going to get this because I saw the word God, and God to me was this, I equated it to the Southern Baptist version that I learned as a child. And then I saw a bunch of men hugging each other, and I certainly didn't want that. And so that was my, you know, that was my first perception of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then this burly old guy getting up and handing me his phone number, saying, "You got to call me every day." I said, "I can't talk. I'm stuttering. You know, what are we going to talk about?" And I never understood that. But you know, and the point I'm trying to make is that in this recovery home, I was taught that in order for me to stay sober, I need to have a psychic change sufficient enough to bring about recovery. And this is the way that I understand this, is that I have this internal discomfort. It's called a spiritual malady. My entire life, I've always looked for external things, a job, her, if she could fix me. You know, I've always looked for external things to make me feel better. You know, I've always looked for something out there, and that's, I'm never quite good enough on the inside. And so what I've discovered about this program is that's what we treat here. We don't treat the person. We treat the spiritual malady. And our literature says when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And so I need to treat this internal discomfort. I need to treat the restlessness and the irritability and the discontent. You know, there's a few men in this room who've known me a while. And up about 5 years ago in my sobriety, I had been staying sober on steps 1, 9, and 12 for a long time. Right? I'm alcoholic. Sorry about that. Let me help you. And there's some men in this room that can contest to that. You know, one in particular who caught the wrath of Paul as he was sitting on the porch, you know. And what happened was that, you know, I wasn't able to, you know, to articulate well. I stuttered when I first got sober, so I wouldn't go to book studies. I stuttered when I first got sober, so I wouldn't read out loud, right? And so what happened because of my fear, is that I memorized a book. And that's been a double-edged sword, let me tell you. Truly has. And so you put a guy with my knowledge of the book, what I perceive to be the program, right, with my type of personality in a internal discomfort mode, and I ripped through a lot of people. I would go up and tell you what you are doing wrong in this program. And I could quote the book. I could tell you, you know, this is what it says. What page, what paragraph, how it's punctuated, right? And then I actually read something, and there's a difference between hearing something and listening. And I actually read something in the book that says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostics, and Paul's personal adventures before and after, drunk or sober, right? 3 days drunk or 10 years sober, my adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. That I'm alcoholic and can't manage my own life, drunk or sober. And that no human power, she can't fix me. You can't fix me. The fellowship can't fix me. Service work can't fix me. And that God could and would if he were sought. Now, kind of bear with me on this. This was, you know, like 5 years ago, I think. And so I'm desperate. My dad had just died. My real dad, my stepdad, the one I call dad. My best friend had just died from brain cancer. And a good friend was murdered. All in like a period of 6 months, and I was reeling, and I was staying sober on 1, 9, and 12. My spiritual fitness was in the toilet, but I could tell you how to do this. And that happened, and I went to church, and then the Pope died. And I was like, okay. I get the message. So what happened is, as I started reading further on that page 60, and it says that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though I'm trying to help you. I went, holy shit, that's me. And I started reading on further, and it says that I'm a good con and manipulator, that I try to arrange the lights and the ballet and the scenery. If you would just do things my way, everything would be okay. And if that doesn't work, I'll con you. Right? This is what, you know, and I read that, and I finally heard what it was saying. I finally heard what this was saying. This is the third step. And so I was never one to actually memorize any prayers out of the book. But what happened is I listened to the speaker, and he explained to me why there's no amen after the third step prayer. The amen's after the seventh step prayer. And so all of these things hit me like a ton of bricks. And I picked up a pencil and a piece of paper. And when I first got sober, I did a complete inventory. Right? That's what I cleared away that wreckage. 10 years sober, I picked up a pencil and a piece of paper. I had done it before, but it was like a little, you know, okay, let's just do this just for show, you know. And so I picked up a pencil and a piece of paper, and I honestly searched out the faults in my makeup that had caused my failure. And I looked at how my resentments kept me away from the sunlight of the Spirit. And I looked at how my fear drove me. And even to this day, sometimes fear drives me, again, I'm very analytical, and I do things black and white. I don't know if you picked that up yet or not, but I'm very black and white. I don't do the idealistic thing, right? I'm a tweaker at heart, and if you give me an idea, you know, it's off and running, right? But if you give me something tangible, something that says that if I do this, I'm going to have this result, right? Very analytical, very black and white, and that's what I did. Is I picked up this book, and it says we listed people, institutions, or principles. I know who people are. I'm pissed off at people all the time. So it's easy for me to write down people. Institutions, marriage is an institution. Valentine's Day is an institution. Christmas is an institution. And then the values, you know, the principles. Those are those values that I grew up with, the ones that drive my fear. Old ideas avail me nothing, so I had to look at why I have these fears. And I had to search back in my childhood of what old idea, what happened that I still live with today about not feeling adequate, about feeling uncomfortable in my own skin, and it goes all the way back there. And so all the successes that I've had in my life, all the successes that I've had staying sober, I didn't do it, but you know, but I'm here. Doesn't mean a hill of beans, but I always go right back to that not being good enough. And so I looked at that through the process of the inventory, and I was amazed. I was able to wake up in the morning after I started looking at that, grateful to be alive. What is happening now is sometimes I have a difficult time shifting over from being the book Nazi, right, to actually able to listen to someone talk about their day. I asked my sponsor, and I've had the same sponsor my entire sobriety, and I've asked my sponsor, and I've never called him once on the phone. That's not required. I asked my sponsor, how do I change passion into compassion? And that's it's just a process. If you're new in the program, this is a very simple program, and this is the way that I understand it. When I drank alcohol, it changed my spirit. Alcohol is a spirit, right? In our literature, it describes the spiritual experience as being a personality change. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. That's on page 27, in case you're interested. That is defined as a spiritual experience. I have a personality change when my ideas change, when my emotions change, and when my attitudes change. The third step, the reason there's no amen after the third step prayer is because the third step treats the ideas, The idea is that I'm not God, and that I have to seek another higher power, and I have to turn my will over, and I have to stop being in collision with something or somebody, even though I'm trying to help you. Right? The fourth step treats my emotions of this spiritual experience, of this personality change, my resentments, my fear, my anger, my lust. I get to analyze my resentments. And in the book, this is the only place that it uses the term analyze. We analyze our resentments. And through that process of me being able to search out those flaws, of looking at why my emotions drive me and why my self-will. And third step, prayer, I ask to be relieved of the bondage of self. And how that bondage of self reflects it is in my resentments, because I'm not getting my way. Right? That's one bondage of self. In fear, because I don't want you to know who I am, and I live in a world that's egocentric about this big. And I'm not concerned about the ripple effect because I need to get mine. And the last part that myself really be relieved of the bondage of self is how I con and manipulate in relationships. And so all of this is the process in the fourth step of me searching out those flaws. And the third step treats my ideas that I'm not God, and I have to stop conning and manipulating people. Fourth step will treat my emotions because I get to look at them and I get to analyze them. And the fifth step, it is not my nature to tell another man the truth about things I've done. That's totally against who I am, because my ego gets smashed, because I'm going to have to tell you these things I did. I'm going to have to tell you that while drinking, I tried to extort $15,000 from this old cripple guy. You know, I'm going to have to tell you things like that. I'm going to have to tell you that I blew up the Hotel Del. I'm going to have to tell you all of these things. I'm going to have to tell you things that's going to make me look bad, and that's not my nature. And that is the inside stuff, and that's how I treat this internal discomfort. About I get to look at why I do things, because I am egocentric. And my world, I'm self-centered and selfish, and left to my own devices, I am not capable of seeing how my actions affect others. These steps, through this process, for me doing a fifth step, I get to see how my actions affect others. That's why they're steps. Normal people don't need these things. Normal people can say, oh, I'm sorry about that. You know, this is what I did. Right? And the proof of all of this, the proof that I have turned my will over to the care of God as I understand Him, is I go knock on somebody's door and I make amends. And amends, you know, is not an apology. Amends is, Mother, these are things I did to you. How can I set this straight? Not an apology, because I've always apologized. My intentions were always to do the right thing, and I never could. An amends is when I knock on this door and say, how can I set this matter straight? And Mother says, son, all I want you to be is happy. So every time I see this woman, I have to be happy. Regardless of what's going on in my life, because that's what she wanted to set this matter straight. That's what an amends is. Black and white. And also, if you're new at the program, please, 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 please pick up this book and read the black stuff. Read the black stuff in here, and I'll share this with you, and I believe that'll be all my time. Forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And ask any alcoholic, what's the main purpose of the book? And they'll say, recover from alcoholism. I do not recover from alcoholism. I don't recover from this ism part. I recover from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which is the allergy and the obsession. That's it. Anywhere in this book where it uses the word we, us, or are, they're talking about the first 100 people. They're not talking about the current fellowship. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, which is the 100 people. Again, I'm black and white. That's just how I had to be, because you wound up here too. And I needed help. I knew I had this thing. Please help me. Don't share your opinion with me. Tell me what I need to do. And a guy says, when the book says to pray, you pray. When it says to write, write. When it says to talk to somebody else, do that. And I picked up that book, and I stayed sober. And a drunk like me is not supposed to stay sober. Congratulations to the gentleman with 30 years. Thank you for staying. Thank you.